question first. Last week we heard that it said now the universe is expanding faster and faster.
Yeah.
So does this affect our present estimations of the age of the universe?
Mm.
And when will we hear about that?
Because
that wasn't covered in the lecture last week, that I heard.
Is that okay? Yeah, that's all right. Thank you. The accelerated universe was discovered in 1999 through some work on supernova explosions, and then was confirmed by some of the results from the microwave anisotropy probe. It's within that context that we then derive the age of the universe to be 13.7 plus or minus 0.1 or 0.2. But you're absolutely right that before some of that work, we probably would have said that the universe was between 10 and 15 billion years old. But now those things go together. What, of course, is interesting from that, to build on this question, if I may, and that is the long-term future of the universe is now, as T.S. Eliot said, it dies with a whimper, not a bang. There's the heat death view of the universe, where increasing acceleration means that the universe becomes larger and larger, energy is dissipated more and more, spread out more and more. Eventually the universe turns into black hole remnants, and the whole thing cools down, becomes a very lifeless place. An end in futility is the prediction of the accelerating universe. So that's quite a sobering thought. Now, for me as a Christian theologian, I'm not worried by that. There's something within the New Testament picture that this creation is good, but God's purposes go beyond our present physical universe to a new heaven and a new earth. And therefore the prediction of future futility of just this universe actually resonates for me with the biblical account. Just in the same way that, with respect, ladies and gentlemen, we're all destined to futility because we're all going to die. But God's purposes go beyond that into resurrection of the body. They go further than just the physical future that's predicted at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you say that there's sort of proof of God that in the creation of the universe of cause and effect? But as I see it, the effect is the universe, the cause is God.
Mm.
There had to be something, some power outside of time to create, something all-powerful, and with a design, and that's the why, the who and the why.
Mm.
But that to me says there must be something, you know, something, a God, and I see it as the God who appeared on Earth 2,000 years ago as Jesus.
Mm. Thank you. I mean, that's a very rich question in terms of the number of issues that are involved there. And the first thing, I think, is to distinguish two ways of understanding the cosmological argument. The first is in temporal form, which is the one that I was saying I wasn't too sure about, because there are problems in extending the logic back, cause and effect. Not least so that Dawkins in The God Delusion says, if you say that the first cause is God, then who caused God? If you're using that kind of logic, you've got to push it all the way back. And in fact, David Hume and Immanuel Kant and others had pointed that out. There is another way of understanding the cosmological argument, which Thomas Aquinas was clear about pointing out, and that is, what's the ultimate cause of things? So not a temporal cause of things, but why is there something rather than nothing? And I think that gives us a stronger kind of argument. However, a number of people would object to the way that you jumped, quite naturally, but for some it's not quite a natural jump to say The cause is the God who reveals himself in Jesus. Because one of the problems with the cosmological argument and the design argument has always been that it may indicate some kind of creator, but what's the nature of that creator? For Hume it was, well, you know, is this just some little architect of the universe or some demiurge who started off? Now I think if you've already come to an understanding that God has revealed himself in Jesus, then you can make that link, which you've done. But I don't think it's easy to argue from cause and effect to say, therefore, this is the God of the Bible. So there's many things that we can talk out a little bit more. But
almost the God we require is defined by the fact that he has to be outside of time. That he has to be all-powerful. You know, if you can believe in God, you say, well, there's especially some sort of force that's always been there and is ultimately powerful. That's the definition of God.
Yeah, but, I mean, fair enough. Although, again, you've opened up some really interesting stuff there. I mean, a God who is outside of time. We haven't got time to deal with that. Sorry for the pun. But, I mean, that's a really big kind of question. What's God's relationship to time? Fair enough. Thank you.
Can I jump to the other end? You talked about the physical universe ending in futility and the Christian hope, sort of ground in the resurrection of Jesus.
Yes.
I'd like to hear what you have to say about the intersection between the destiny of the physical universe and the new heavens and new earth, how they intersect. If you've got something you'd like to say about that, I'd be keen to hear it.
I'm really glad that we're dealing with all the easy questions this evening. And the really crass thing for me to say is that I have written a book about this. And you want the money back? Is that this is really an important point because as a physicist, I want to really ask the question: what do we get in the resurrection that gives us a model for understanding the future of the physical stuff of the universe? And to cut a long argument short, but let me just pick out the kind of bullet points and then we can talk a little bit more. Apostle Paul talks about the resurrection as the first fruits of that which is to come. So I see the resurrection of Jesus both as the evidence for God's purposes going beyond this universe, and as a model for that which is to come. And in the resurrection of Jesus, we see both continuity and discontinuity between the Jesus who died on the cross and the Jesus who was raised again. He was the same, but different. He wasn't limited to space and time in the way that we seem to be limited to space and time. So first of all, might we begin to think about that concept of being limited by space and time? This comes back, sir, to your point about God's relationship to time. Maybe the resurrection is pointing us towards a sense of time being real, but not limiting us in the same way. And one of the ways that people have thought about this traditionally in the past in regard to space is to think about extra dimensions of space. What about if in the new creation, the new heavens and the new earth, there were extra dimensions of space-time? In that it was real, but not limiting because of the one dimension of time that we experience. Now there is a little bit of evidence for this already in our current theories of the origin of the universe, which talk about if M theory is correct or string theory is correct, we need 11 or maybe 26 dimensions of space. They're all wrapped up so that we can't experience them. But what if they're opened up in new creation so that we experience them? In terms of matter, the physical stuff of the universe, then I'm less clear, and I'm starting to struggle, and I'm beginning to think through these things. It can't be that God simply reassembles the atoms which make up our body at the moment, because those cycle every few years or so in and out of our bodies. The key is the way that the matter encodes the information pattern that defines our identity as human beings. Both are important, the physical embodiment and the information content, the pattern that of past memories, future possibilities, current relationships, all the rest of it. Now, I think John Polkinghorne has gone some way to say you could embody the information pattern on a different structure, just as you were to take a software program and put it on a different piece of hardware. But that doesn't get to the core of your question, which is how is the matter different? And I think that it's something about the relationality of matter that is transformed. The way that atoms relate together, how structures relate together, that may be the source of transformation. So that atoms may be the same, but the way that they hold together, configure, or whatever. Now, as you can tell, I'm just really speculating here. And I should have replied in answer to your question, I don't know. And it would have saved us an awful lot of time. But those are the type of things that I want to explore.
Yes, I thought I'd get back to the time issue was on my mind as well.
Yeah.
So are people exploring the possibility that time is not linear? I mean, we can't conceive anything but, and all the physics is built around a system of linearity, discrete, whatever it is, of time. Is it possible that time is not linear? That time is, and so the expansion of the universe at an increasing rate is somehow not that because time is not linear. Are people exploring that type of
Maybe
theory?
Not in that sense, but I think in two ways. The first is, what would a universe look like if it had more than one dimension of time? And there are models at the moment which are being explored in that way. The second thing is, remember, Hawking's modelling of the very first moment shows us that time may be more complicated than we think. So that Hawking's guess on how to bring together quantum theory and general relativity is to say that as you go to t equals naught, time itself dissolves into a spatial dimension. And therefore time disappears. In John Barrow's phrase, once upon a time there was no time, is the way that he puts it.
Would it devolve heading the other direction to the infinite?
Not within that particular understanding of quantum theory. However, time is a really odd thing to understand, because the other viewpoint is, of course, what we've known for about 100 years, which is in the sense of Einstein's relativity theory, both special and general, that although it's linear, our measurement of time depends on how we're moving and how close to a gravitational mass we are. And you get various paradoxes, that time moves at different speeds depending on how you're moving, that some of the equations of general relativity around rather exotic black holes can mean that there are loops of space-time in which you can travel back in time, so that time travel is theoretically possible. Two reasons why we don't think it's possible. The first is that there's a really high probability that if you use this curve around a black hole to go back in time, you might crash into yourself if you're coming out. And the second is that if time travel was possible in the future, then where are they? We've not seen anyone come back. Now, all of this means, I think, that time is more subtle than we've given it credit for. It still may be linear, but our understanding of time may be far more complicated than we think.
How does gravity work?
Gosh. In the beginning of the 20th century, Einstein gave a really brilliant understanding of gravity. And, sir, may I borrow your Manchester United scarf? Would that be all right? I'm a Newcastle supporter. Would you mind helping me with this? If you would just stand up and just take the two corners of that there. And sir, would you mind helping as well? Would you just stand up and take the two corners there? And if you keep that taut, okay? And don't worry, we'll give it back to you afterwards. So, Einstein, gravity. What Einstein said was, imagine that space-time is a stretchy fabric. Now, the best way to do this is with a rubber sheet. We haven't got a rubber sheet, we've got a Manu scarf that will do. And Einstein said, if a mass is around, then the space-time is curved or warped. It was flat, it's now curved or warped. Now, if I had a little golf ball, or a table tennis ball, or something like that, and I put it on the scarf, what would happen? It would roll down the slope. The large mass would attract the small mass. And that is a brilliant definition of gravity, a description of gravity. It's about the warping of space-time. Now, do you remember we talked about the laws of physics breaking down at 10 to the minus 43 of a second? This is a really good illustration to also talk about that, because at 10 to the minus 43 of a second, instead of my hand being there, imagine if there was a very, very large mass in a very small space. I'm a very, very large mass. If I jumped onto this scarf, the consequences would be catastrophic. These two gentlemen's heads would come in, they'd bang together, we'd all end up in the floor in a mess, it would be complete pandemonium. In fact, that's what happens with the mathematics of general relativity at 10 to the minus 43 a second. It can't cope with the scale of the warping of space-time. So that, for me, is one of the best descriptions of gravity. Give these two guys a big hand and a massive
Dawkins would say, probably has said, that in the beginning, man created God to explain, I don't understand, the God of the gaps.
Yeah.
With dark matter and dark energy, you said that scientists know that they're there, but they don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Is that not science inventing something to explain what they don't understand, namely why the universe continues to expand?
It's a fair point. I think yes and no, maybe. Dark matter we know is there because of the way that we've seen it produce a number of effects within not just the way that galaxies are stable, but also how galaxies move, and then the clustering of galaxies. So dark matter really does seem to be there, and it's an observational effect. And we've got a number of candidates for what it may be. And if the LHC comes back online, then there's a possibility that we might see it. Dark energy is a more difficult thing to talk about in the light of your question, because in one sense we don't know what it is. And there are some alternatives explaining some of the supernova observations, particularly without invoking dark energy. So, for example, it could be that the gravitational law, big G, the gravitational constant, varies on very large scales. You could use that to try and fit the results of the accelerating universe. Or you could say that actually even after 10 years or so, our observations aren't good enough to justify dark energy. The microwave background radiation again seems to suggest that it really is dark energy. But I think we hold it tentatively at the moment. Certainly until we've got some agreement on theoretically what the dark energy might be. There's a number of candidates. I mean, it may be. I mean, God of the Gaps, I think, is a bad theological move. I mean, every time people have tried to use it, it's been supplanted. But I think it's right to point to areas in science where scientific dogmatism squeezes out a sense of the limits of science. I think there's a difference between saying that there's gaps in science to there may be limits. Science is a very successful activity because it does have limits. It limits the kind of questions it has for the universe. And so when we come to multiverse as an explanation for fine-tuning, for me, because the existence of other universes, it seems unlikely that we can ever have any information passed from one universe to another. It's not a scientific theory. It's a philosophical explanation. And yet it masquerades often as a scientific theory. As this is a scientific theory, whereas belief in God is a metaphysical thing. And so sometimes there's a dogmatism about scientific theory which is brought in, and it's applied in areas that it shouldn't. So God of the Gaps, no. Questioning some of the scientific explanations, absolutely. That's what we need to do all of the time, because no scientific theory is 100%. Needs to be improved, questioned. But let's remember that science does have its limits, it seems to me.
Any other questions? And, probably a very strange question, just talk about the time that you can break down in the beginning of the universe. Wondering, like for example, morality, which is, I'm not sure if it's physics or a thing, but how does that relate to time or the universe, or can it exist without an intelligent thing, or does it break down in the 10th of the minus 43, and how does morality relate to a physical atomic world? Yeah.
Judah, I've never thought about that before. And I think I need to think about it for a little longer. I don't have an easy answer to it. The trick of when you don't know the answer to the question is to say, and what do you think? Do you have a view on it? Do you have a view on it?
God.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's a good answer. It's a good answer. I mean, let's just develop this for a little bit. What is the origin of morality? What's the origin of law within the universe? And does that stand apart from the universe, or in some way is it tied up in the universe? Well, I would be one who says morality, value, is a reflection of the goodness and holiness of God. It's intrinsically part of God himself. Just as I'd say that the scientific laws are a reflection of God's faithful way of upholding the universe. What I'm a little worried about is to think about the laws of science or morality as somehow existing apart from God. They are for me a reflection of who God is and how he relates to the universe. And therefore, whether it's 10 to minus 43 of a second or now, God is always the one who's sustaining the universe. And God is not dependent on the universe. There are, as some of you know, some models of God which tie him very closely to the universe. Process theology, panentheism, as it's sometimes called. And that, for me, makes God dependent on the universe in a way that I don't think is true to the biblical account. I'm waffling, I better stop.
What about evil?
Sorry, what about evil? I think evil is a really complicated thing. I think there's a sense in which evil is about the absence of good. I think evil is about the abuse of freedom given to human beings to choose the good in the universe. I think there's a dimension which I don't fully understand, but I want to take seriously, of evil in the heavenly realm, which in biblical terms is envisaged in Satan and the demons. So I think in all of those ways, the term evil covers a whole number of things. And then there's also the way that we often use evil for innocent suffering, for earthquakes and disease and things of that sort.
I meant
say it a bit more.
In the context of what you said, how does morality relate? You answered in terms of physics and God.
Yeah.
Are you answering in terms of physics and God here? Is there
something? No, I don't think I am. Although, there are some who wanted to suggest that God gives to the physical process within the universe, not just to humans, but the physical process, a degree of freedom, a limited degree of freedom within the process. And they point to uncertainty in quantum theory, uncertainty in chaos, to say that the universe has a degree of openness to it. I think sometimes that can be taken too far, and people say, well, the universe is either completely predictable or completely open. Actually, it's much more complicated than that. But in that way, John Polkinghorne and one or two others use a free process defense for evil, which is parallel to the freedom of choice defense for human evil. And I think that's worth thinking about. If you're an evangelical Christian, you'll know that it's caused huge controversy in the US. Over whether it's part of being an Orthodox Christian or not.
All right, just one last question, I think.
Yeah, I've got a few books I've never tried to get together because I probably get myself confused if I do. Miracles, which is maybe God working against his own laws. Which is probably wrong way of saying it. And then there's always Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which gives God room to move because you can't predict anything. What would you say about those issues?
Those two things. Very briefly, as time's going on, we've only got about 4 hours to answer that question tonight. First of all, I'm not a great fan of using the uncertainty principle at the quantum level to give God space to work in the universe. The reason for that is that we still do not understand the relationship of the uncertainty at the quantum level with the everyday level. What's called the problem of the collapse of the wave function, how the quantum level relates to the everyday level, is really difficult to understand. And by trying to use that model for how God works, I think it's difficult. In terms of miracles, let me say, I unashamedly believe in miracles. And I don't have a problem with that. with a few qualifications. The first is, I'm not sure that miracles is actually a very good biblical term to use. The Bible often uses signs and wonders rather than miracles. And secondly, miracles are overlaid with a whole kind of Western tradition of philosophy, which sometimes is helpful and not. But in terms of, does God have the freedom to go beyond his usual ways of working? Yes, for me. Now, we've got to be careful in that there has to be some kind of tension. If the laws of science are a reflection of the faithfulness of God, then a law-like universe is really important for us to develop and to learn. If God was doing this, that, and the other in a chaotic way, we wouldn't be able to learn or develop. We wouldn't learn responsibility. I have two teenage children. Over, thank you. Over their growing up, they've had certain bedtimes. You know, you say, that's your bedtime, and that gives them the ability to judge what they want to do, and there's some structure to what it is. But there are moments during my children's growing up where Newcastle United have been playing Manchester United on the television, which goes beyond their normal bedtime. At that time, as a gracious and good parent, I go beyond the normal bedtimes to say, yes, you can stay up. I think that's an act of grace, or maybe not, actually. I mean, there are moments where I think God goes beyond his normal ways of working for his own purposes in acts of grace that don't break his own laws but supersede his own usual ways of working. Now, don't get me wrong, because while saying that, you then open up a huge problem, a problem of evil. If God has the capacity to do that, why doesn't he do it more often? And why does he seem to give a Christian a parking space when the Christian prays for a parking space, rather than deal with my friend's cancer? And the problem of evil there is the biggest problem for me in miracles. Not the relationship with science, but the problem of evil of why God chooses to do some things and not other things. But I want to live with that messiness, I think, because I see those miracles in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, particularly his resurrection. There are some theologians who simply say, we'll get God off the hook of the problem of evil by saying that he can't work in any particular way. I just think we've got to live with the messiness, but acknowledge that it is really